Thousands of pro-gay Russians have united to fight a bill that will ban people from coming out as gay. The State Duma will decide on a bill that calls for people who say, "I'm gay," out loud, or are affectionate with a same-sex partner in public, to be fined 5,000 rubles, roughly $80, and to be jailed for 15 days. The proposed bill is only targeting gay men because, according to the bill's authors, women are more reasonable and can manage their emotions. The Anglican Church on Thursday handed the U.S. Episcopal Church a 3-year suspension as punishment for its support of gay marriage and for allowing its clergy to perform same-sex marriages. During this time, the U.S. branch will be barred from any policy-setting positions in the Anglican Communion. Threats of a schism came to the surface as early as 2003 when the U.S. Episcopal Church ordained its first openly gay bishop, Gene Robinson. On Friday, the Archbishop of Canterbury apologized for the hurt and pain the Anglican Church has inflicted on LGBTI people, even as he defended his decision to sanction the U.S. Episcopal Church for allowing same-sex marriage. In Ireland, trans youth worker Ellen Murray announced that she will be standing in West Belfast in assembly elections in May. In doing so, the 22-year-old is the first transgender candidate in Northern Ireland and on the island of Ireland. Ms. Murray talked about giving a voice to groups with clear underrepresentation within the Assembly, including women, young people, and the LGBTQ community. Women whose resumes suggest that they may be lesbian, bisexual, or transgender are less likely to receive a callback for a job interview, according to a study published in the sociology journal Socius. The study conducted a field experiment by sending out a pair of fictitious women's resumes to more than 800 administrative jobs from online job databases advertised by employers across 4 states. One resume was randomly assigned leadership experience at an LGBT student association to signal queer identity, while the other resume, the control, was assigned experience at another progressive student organization, but otherwise similar qualifications and credentials. Titled "Discrimination Against Queer Women in the U.S. Workforce," the study showed that the women with the LGBT indicator were discriminated against compared with other women, receiving about 30% fewer callbacks. Numerous attempts to restrict where transgender people can use the restroom have been proposed in recent years, but one Virginia lawmaker's latest legislation might be the most vicious. He actually wants to fine transgender children $50 if they use what he deems to be the wrong restroom. Enforcement would be based on a show-me-your-papers model, where individuals would have to produce a birth certificate matching their gender expression in order to use the restroom. Profiling of trans people would likely follow, and given that many trans people do not undergo the surgery necessary to change their birth certificates, they would remain incredibly vulnerable for prosecution. In Kansas, supporters of an anti-discrimination bill that would protect gay, lesbian, and transgender Kansans from discrimination told a House committee Thursday the bill is needed to protect those individuals from needless harassment, abuse, and discrimination. Opponents of the bill said it would open the floodgates to lawsuits against churches and even business owners who object to gay and lesbian relationships on religious grounds, and that would result in a loss of religious freedoms for others. House Bill 2323, which would add sexual orientation and gender identity to the list of protected classifications in the Kansas Act Against Discrimination, was discussed at the meeting. Sandra Mead of Olathe, a Navy veteran, former Defense Department analyst, and who has also been a host of Trans Talk here on the 10th Voice, told the panel of the difficulties that she and other transgender residents face in a state such as Kansas that offers them no legal protections, telling them that once they come out, many transgender people are faced with a loss of respect and privilege, regardless of their personal history, prior to the moment they came out. She added, "It's as if prior life experience and accomplishments were of no value and their dreams and hopes of no interest." Representative Jan Pauls, Republican of Hutchison, a member of the committee, testified against the bill, saying it would dilute the rights of all other protected classes in the non-discrimination law because the bill would protect both homosexual and heterosexual individuals from discrimination, stating that, quote, "Our concern is that once you add sexual orientation, that basically protects every individual in the state," unquote. And that is our news, Miguel.
All right. Thank you for all those messages of information. some troubling, some work to be done, but no different than our everyday life. So
exactly. It's all about the struggle every day.
It's all about the struggle, yeah. And the struggle is real. Talking about real, I mean, God, David Bowie, you couldn't get more real than that guy. I mean, he spoke to every gender, every persuasion, every lifestyle, every ethnicity, even though he seemed to come across as just this British, thin white guy. But I think that's what he worked, is to kind of move beyond those categories and to touch people and to challenge them artistically and, you know, cerebrally with his words and his music and the visuals that he brought were just incredible. And I'm just a casual David Bowie fan. I knew of his work in, you know, the 80s with Modern Love and that kind of stuff, Let's Dance. But so I'm glad that we have, you know, Mark Manning here to kind of give us the in-depth information. And Phil, you put together a great dossier on Bowie and all these other artists. Wow. I know there's not going to be enough time to go into all of this, but I really am thankful to both of you for being here. So maybe we should just kind of start at the beginning. Who is David Bowie, and where did he come from, and how did he kind of find his way into our consciousness?
So that would be you, Mark. You are our local guest expert.
Well, I don't know. I think it's really interesting that so many people this week have been writing so much about Bowie and what he meant to them and how he does cross generations of people and all walks of life. And I don't know his actual hometown in England. We should look that up and find out maybe. But
I'll ask Mr. Google.
He was one of those people that studied art. And I think one of the things I remember hearing about him when he first got into music is he said he wanted to just be a saxophone player in Little Richard's band. Hmm. That's what he really wanted to do. And he played the saxophone, actually. That's one of his instruments that he played. But his career, he started singing professionally in 1963, and he really didn't break through with a song that really reached a wider audience until Space Oddity. Hmm. You remember that song? Space Oddity. Mm. It was a song that actually had a second life when they actually had the moon landing, because the BBC used it as a theme song for a lot of their coverage of the moon landing.
Incidentally, he was born and raised in South London.
Thank you. You'll be our Wikipedia special person here.
Well, it's Wikipedia's 15th anniversary, you know.
It is.
I one of the things he did, I think, with his music was he continually reinvented himself. Mm-hmm. He was always staying new. So for a lot of people that got to know him, they would get to know him in that new period, learn about that music that they liked, and then go with him into the future, but also go back and find out about the things he did in the past. And mm-hmm. for me, the first song, I mean, I knew about his song Fame, because that was really, was the number one song in 1975, 76, off the Young Americans period of his plastic soul period, basically, where he was experimenting with soul music and recording in Philadelphia. Luther Vandross was one of the people that he worked with a lot at that period.
1975.
Thank you. But it really broke through to me when I was in my process of coming out as a gay person, and I was staying overnight at a friend's house, and she woke me up with the song Young Americans on her stereo really loud. And I remember waking up, and the song just went into me, and I heard it in a whole different way, and I was like, who is this person? And then I spent the rest of the summer finding every Bowie I could find. And I went back. He had just put out an album. He was Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, and he was also on Broadway in The Elephant Man. Mm-hmm. And both of that play and that album and all of his music deal with characters who are feeling isolated. They're feeling alone. They're feeling like they need to get out of where they are to another place, and they don't fit in. And he kind of dealt with that theme through all of his music, through all of his changes mm-hmm. of his life. He kind of dealt with that. And as a gay kid in a small town in Nebraska, I related to that. I was like, that is how I feel. Mm-hmm. And he was my gateway drug to to so much else, because by going back and learning about Ziggy Stardust, the Spiders from Mars, his album Hunky Dory in 1971 was very influenced by the Velvet Underground and Andy Warhol, and he wrote a song called Andy Warhol. Mm-hmm. And he went and saw Warhol and met him and sang the song for him. Wow. And Warhol was like, I like your shoes. But while he was visiting Warhol, they went to see a play. I think it was a play called Pork. And Angie Bowie, his wife at the time, loved all the costumes of the people in the factory. And that's what influenced Ziggy Stardust. So we have Warhol to thank for the Velvet Underground, for one thing, but also for inspiring David Bowie in so many ways. And really, Ziggy Stardust kind of came out of that, what he saw at the factory. So all of these things were connecting in my brain as a young gay kid, learning about Bowie. And then by learning about Bowie, you can learn about all these other subculture heroes, because Bowie wasn't really popular in America until Let's Dance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Really.
Yeah.
That was sort of a breakthrough for him. Yeah. And when that album came out, he went on the cover of Rolling Stone. Straight was the headline. He came out as a heterosexual before he did that, because mainly because of the American audiences don't accept bisexuality the way European audiences have no problem with it.
Because I traced the history of that, because in 1972, he said in an interview that he was gay. And in 76, he told Playboy magazine he was bisexual.
Yes.
Married to Angie at the time.
And he didn't just say he was bisexual. He said it was, he couldn't deny the fact that it was probably the best thing that ever happened to him.
And
not many people were saying that in 1976.
Later, he also said it was the biggest mistake he ever made, because he didn't feel like he was a real bisexual. He said, frankly, his same-sex interactions were not enjoyable. Later said he was a closeted heterosexual. But in terms of sexual relationships, his own description of himself as promiscuous is probably what hits the mark the most.
Yeah. And to add on to that, in 2002, Blender magazine asked him about him declaring that it was a mistake. And he said, I don't think it was a mistake in Europe, but I think it was a lot tougher in America. I had no problem with people knowing I was bisexual, but I had no inclination to hold up banners nor be a representative of any group of people. I knew what I wanted to be, which was a songwriter and a performer, and I felt that bisexuality became my headline over here in the U.S. America's a very puritanical place, and I think it stood in the way of so much I wanted to do. I really think he could have had an even greater success in America had he been straight all along.
More closeted.
Because a lot of gay people I know who identified with him in the Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane period would keep it a secret from their friends. Hmm. Because if their friends knew that they liked Bowie, that was even more reason that they were queer or whatever the word was.
Yeah,
I've heard that from a number of people who kept it a secret. And that's what we all had. We all thought we had a private relationship with this person.
So back in the day, there was Friends of Dorothy, but then there became like Friends of Bowie.
It's true.
That was the way to kind of gauge people.
If people loved Bowie, that meant that you had a connection with them, that you had an understanding about something. Mm-hmm. And then when Let's Dance came out, it was almost like, okay, I have to share him with all these college people now.
The shoulder pad era.
Right. Yeah. But then he quickly went back to experimenting and trying new sounds and going in different directions. And, you know, I mean, he made over 27 studio albums, 49 compilation albums and 8 live albums. It's a huge amount of material that he created.
Well, and it seems to me that in a lot of ways the personas that he would keep creating were a lot like how gay people, certainly at that time, would create a public persona that was different from their private persona, so that they wouldn't have to, you know, not have record sales in America in any way you choose to make that metaphor.
Yeah.
And the personas always seem to be some sort of metaphor as well for what was going on, and particularly in ways that he could express something about his own identity.
I agree. He was a very, very private person, and that can be said for the fact that none of us knew that he had been suffering with cancer for the last 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He kept all of that very private, and no one ever knew about you know, pictures of his house where he lived, or his wife Iman and their daughter Lexi, and it was all very private. I think he understood the theater of all of that, that there's a backstage and there's an onstage, and when you let people see backstage, it kind of, the mystery and the magic is not as much there, you know.
Once you know how you saw the woman in half, you never look at it the same way again.
Exactly. Because he was very theatrical. I mean, I think he understood theater. I mean, he introduced the bus and truck tours to rock and roll. He wanted to do Broadway rock and roll the way Broadway did touring Broadway shows. And after that, Kiss, they started doing that kind of a show. And now we see it at the Sprint Center. Just when Madonna comes to town, there's like, I don't know, 8 semi-trucks down there? You know?
So, this is something I've always wondered about artists. Do they take hold, and are they great because they touch on the topics that are happening at the time, or is it the times that make the artist, you know, what it is? And so how do you feel that about Boyer that way?
I've always thought that he was ahead of his time, that he actually could somehow take everything that was happening in the world and translate it, and all of his influences. Because one of his interviews, he talks about bringing pantomime to rock and roll and kabuki theater to rock and roll and all these things that nobody was thinking about. But I think he actually saw the future a little bit, and all of his music is still good. I mean, this recordings that were put out in 1870 still sound fresh and great today.
He either saw what the future was, or he created the future by sheer experimentation. And not all of his experiments panned out that way. But a lot of them did. A lot of people saw, oh, there's this. Mm-hmm. I want to do glam rock.
Uh-huh. Right. I think, maybe getting back to your question, I think, you know, I think he dealt with universal issues that outsiders feel, people that feel a little bit outside, maybe the black sheep of their family, because I think definitely he was in his family, and that artist in a family that is with people that aren't artists, and like... Because I remember telling my parents I wanted to be a theater major was almost worse than telling them I was gay, you know?
Well, and the arts become a place where a lot of weirdos end up. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm a weirdo in that sense myself, as is our engineer, Maria Vasquez-Boy. And it seems to be a place where people... rely on expressing themselves anyway, and so they're able to express more of themselves than you ordinarily do in a lot of society. So with that, which seems to have put a stop to the conversation, we have some things we really want you to listen to. Here they are.
This week, we talk with Alan Chambers about his decision to close Exodus International and walk away from the notion that you can, quote, pray away the gay.
We marginalized, we hurt people.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right after your Fusion Funkmeister.
This time on Jaws of Justice Radio, we take you to the demonstration More Squared and One Struggle KC held to tell the KC Police Department that 47 killings in 10 years is not acceptable. And we talk about restorative justice with Brian Goins of the Center for Conflict Resolution. Jaws of Justice Radio, 9 a.m. Monday, right after Democracy Now!
Hi, this is Miguel Morales, and we are back having a discussion about the wonderful David Bowie with Mark Manning and Phil Hoosier and our beautiful engineer, Maria Vasquez-Boyd. Oh, pish, you. So we were talking about the influence of Bowie as an artist, and does he reflect the times, or did the times reflect him? And we kind of decided that he kind of projected us into the future. Things were on the starting gate ready to go, but he's the one who kind of like hit the gun and they just started this marathon. So we're talking about just all the different personas he had. Maybe we can kind of run through some of the different personas he had. Maybe you can kind of explain or break them down of, you know, who the androgynous guy was and the Major Tom, all these characters. I'm not really familiar with too many of them.
Yeah, well, Major Tom was from Space Oddity in
1969.
1969, and that song got reissued a couple different times for different reasons. And then he went into kind of, I would say he was almost like a hippie folk singer with a guitar, long hair, wearing a women's dress on The Man Who Sold the World, that album cover. And then the hunky-dory period was really so much about his own life. There's a great song in there called Kooks that he wrote for his son, Zoe, who got renamed Duncan, who's now a filmmaker. But then
Hunky Dory, 1971.
A great album, by the way. And then the Ziggy Stardust period, that's when the Aladdin Sane character with the orange hair and the all of that makeup and that glam rock, which influenced a lot of people, but it was also going on in England at that time. And
as he says of that period, and Ziggy Stardust, I mean, he was half out of sci-fi and half out of the Japanese theater. The clothes were at that time simply outrageous. Nobody had seen anything like them before.
Exactly. Amazing costuming. A lot of clothes that were intended for women to wear that he was wearing on stage. A lot of really interesting knitted things. There's a documentary film called The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust that you can rent or watch that documented that whole concert that didn't get released until the 80s, actually. But it kind of documents that whole hysteria of that glam rock. And that's really if you haven't checked out that album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, it's a really
1972.
Classic. It's a classic album. There's just lots of great songs on there. And lots of really homoerotic lyrics and imagery in that album, if you listen to the words. Really cool. And that kind of led into Diamond Dogs, that big tour of Diamond Dogs, and then the Thin White Duke period, and the plastic soul of young Americans and the Philly sound. He just kept changing and evolving all the time, trying to come up with something new. He said he didn't feel comfortable being himself on stage until later on in life. So I think for him, like with a lot of actors, if you can have a character to kind of hide behind, you can have a lot more courage on stage.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things I recall reading just recently was someone's memory of him. They were singing backup for him on Saturday Night Live. They'd barely met once, and they were supposed to meet him in the lobby, and they're sitting there, and this scraggly, bearded guy comes up to them, and says they're there to meet David Bowie. And it's like about 5 minutes into it, they realize, that's David Bowie. Because he was absolutely nothing like any of his stage personas.
He kind of dealt with things that were darker. I mean, he was scary to some people. Some people in the early Bowie, the Ziggy Stardust, some of that scared people because they weren't sure how to actually deal with that kind of androgyny.
I grew up Donna Summer, Captain and Tennille. So when I saw people like David Bowie, I'm like, what is that?
Exactly.
And Queen even did the same thing for me. I'm like, what? What's that noise? You know. So anything out of like their restricted pop era of the disco time was just too much for my 12-year-old brain to like come
No, in, you're so. Exactly right. So many people, my friend Marion is the same way, that she was kind of scared of him at first because you just weren't sure what was going on. And he's doing things on stage with Mick Ronson, his lead guitarist, where you're wondering, are they lovers? Are they together? What's the deal? You know, and
why is Bruce Springsteen kissing his sax player?
Exactly.
But he also, there's sort of a tradition of theatricality and flamboyance that he comes out of in his stage personas that seems to have, in part, a little Noel Coward, a little Liberace, who was all about this theatricality and glam, and Little Richard as well, in really creating this wild, flamboyant, gay stage persona, but then keeping their sex life completely out.
Well, if you read much about Little Richard, he does talk about wild orgies, crazy orgies, you know, and then going to church the next day and all that. He has a really interesting biography, but Bowie worshipped him. Little Richard was a huge influence to Bowie, and I would agree with you about the Little Richard. I'm not sure about the Liberace and Neil Coward.
Just that theatricality of it all,
right.
of the presentation, as well as having that the gay persona that is being played for a straight audience.
Yes. I would say, I in one regard, I agree with you. In the other regard, I think they were both brilliant. Like, I love Noel Coward, of course. He's one of my favorite people of all time, and a great, amazing lyricist. But he also knew how to play the game and kind of play it safe, and Liberace, too, to some extent. But
So what I'm saying, just to be clear, is that's the tradition that's in there, the thin boy, like he did so many times, instead of pushing against the boundary that's there for an audience, he just sort of bounds over it and says, no, I'm going to go much farther than what the boundary is. I'm not pushing the envelope. I'm in a whole different zip code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what I mean.
No, I hear you. I hear you.
So how did the whole Bing Crosby Christmas Carol... I kind of never really figured out the story of how that happened. I don't know if you have any insight to that.
So much of the, like, 75 to 80 period of his career, he did so much television. He was on the Dinah Shore show two or three times doing Young Americans. There's a really interesting interview that he did with Dick Cavett, where he actually gets a little bit irritated with Dick Cavett because people ask the craziest questions. Yeah. But he does the Cher show and sings this like 10-minute medley of pop songs of the day that start off with Young Americans and end up with Young Americans, but sing like Neil Diamond in the middle somewhere and all this other stuff. It's just hilarious. He did so many of those things to try to, you know, promote a record, to sell a record.
And in many ways, nothing is more subversive than playing it pop, than playing it straight.
I mean, he was whatever, you know, he also thinks of Los Angeles as the most horrible place in the world and the worst part of his life. Mm-hmm. And he was having a huge cocaine problem then. And he was post that period when he did the Bing Crosby. Mm-hmm. That's kind of during the Low album when he went to Berlin in 77 and 78 and recorded a trilogy of albums called Low, Heroes, and Lodger. And he worked with Brian Eno. And he worked in a studio in Berlin, and they performed Heroes at the Wall.
Wow.
And there were people on the other side of the wall listening to the concert. And the Chancellor of Germany actually gives Bowie credit for helping to bring down the wall as one of the people. Like, I think he had more to do with bringing down the wall than Ronald Reagan.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, for sure. But he was. It was during that period of that he did the Bing Crosby stuff.
Mm. And for people who are also interested in that, Bing Crosby was going to film his Christmas special. Someone on the staff thought it would be a unique idea to have Bowie sing it with him. Bowie, however, didn't like the song "Little Drummer Boy," so the team of songwriters was there. They came up with the piece on earth to be sung as a counterpoint melody with Little Drummer Boy, played the song for him, and an hour later, cameras rolled.
Wow. And Bowie had lots of different voices inside of him. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you listen to his music, he has all these different kinds of sounds to his voice. Like, I always thought to properly sing Let's Dance, you have to sound like you're about to die. Let's dance. But he was a crooner. Yeah. He also could be a crooner, just like Bing.
Yeah, you know? that performance just kind of had me... and still does have me mesmerized when I see it, because it's so contradictory to all the images I have of him. And so every Christmas I have to play the hell out of that song because it's just so awesome.
The 70s were so much about clashing of cultures and the old guard and the new guard, because Bing was this other period of the recording industry that was huge in its day, but... Yeah.
And it was kind of his decline as well, Bing Crosby, and kind of that era, and the rise of this other era. So it was this real unique transition period. So one thing I wanted to ask about is, what is it about Bowie that allowed him to, like, deliver these different messages in different personas and different, you know, kind of genres of music, whereas today, and even back that time, you know, you stayed in your lane. You didn't deviate out of disco or out of country or whatever, but he could jump around into these different genres, and people accepted that, you know? I mean, but by and large, he had some failures as well, but, I mean, some missteps, but what was it about that he was able to experiment and people would just welcomely open that?
For background, David Bowie's many genres include art rock, hard rock, glam rock, alternative rock, kraut rock, proto-punk, post-punk, electronica, blue-eyed or plastic soul, new wave, industrial, techno, jazz, dance music, funk disco, very careful to put an N in that word, experimental rock, folk. He was an instrumentalist, also did ambient and house music.
Well, there you go.
I think it was out of necessity, yeah. Miguel. I really do. I think it was part of his life. Some of his albums are influenced by his personal life at the time, very much so. The Berlin trilogy, he was really trying to get away from L.A. and the crazy life. He had a huge cocaine problem there, and he had, like, shriveled down into nothing practically. Mm. And he needed to get himself healthy, and he went to a place away from it all. Hmm. And the Let's Dance also, when he put out Let's Dance, he did a lot of interviews where he talked about how he had to just remove himself from the club. That's how he put it. He couldn't be with this group of people that he was with because they were causing him to become unhealthy. So he had to totally start over and move himself out of that. Black Tie, White Noise is one of his albums that not his most successful album commercially or critically, but it was influenced by his marriage. And it was he wrote songs for that album that were included in his wedding ceremony to Iman. He's sort of celebrating a union of black and white in an interesting way on that album itself, because he was very influenced by black music, mm-hmm. as a lot of the British rock and rollers are. They kind of reintroduced black music to American audiences.
Yeah.
Who overlooked that music, but not in England.
Black Tie, White Noise is the 18th studio album by David Bowie. It was released in 1993.
So talking about how music influenced him, how did he influence music? I mean, it's just hands down that he's influenced all generations of musicians. But maybe we can kind of, like, run through some of them that you think that have, you know, kind of honored that legacy of his.
Oh, gosh, there's so many. I mean, New Order, the band New Order, Cure, Susie and the Banshees. I mean, so many of these bands got the courage to do what they were doing because of Bowie. Let's just go out there and do it. It's hard to say. There's just so many. Mm-hmm. It's a huge list. My mind is going to the people that he influenced who already were making music at the time, like Iggy Pop and Lou Reed. He was really instrumental in helping them make some of the most successful music of their careers. Philip, do you have some things to add?
Yeah, I think one of the most direct influences and someone that he worked with as a duet partner was, of course, Freddie Mercury. Mm-hmm. Freddie Mercury's the direction that he took the band Queen was a totally theatrical direction, and it's even, you know, right there in A Night in the Opera, in the title of the album, as well as Bohemian Rhapsody, which, incidentally, mm-hmm. there's someone who's written a very scholarly book on his background. Freddie Mercury's says that Bohemian Rhapsody was his coming out song, which actually has been confirmed by someone who was close to him. Wow. And so he has the whole thing of I've killed a man is killing off an old persona, and that the little silhouette of a man is him still being haunted by the old persona, which then he found the courage to break. He wants to break free. Mm-hmm. To break free from the long hair of heavy metal, to that very butch, mm-hmm. gay persona, with the short hair and the songs he performed in black leather shorts and one in a black leather bra, which I think was I Want to Break Free, the video for that. Still among his fans, though, there is a certain denial of Freddie Mercury's sexuality, with some people who say, no, it was all part of the act. And others were saying, it just doesn't matter what his sexuality was. And yet I think it does, because that forms a lot of the basis for how they are as artists, how we all are as artists. Yeah. It forms a lot of what we start to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. And one of my favorite songs is the duet that Bowie and Freddie Mercury do, Under Pressure.
Yes,
1982.
Yeah. So, I mean, could you do you know the story behind that, how that came to happen, or... But
Philip can tell us, right?
How they came to do a duet?
It was really Freddie's idea. The whole it was for the Queen, and they asked Bowie, and Bowie contributed lyrics. What's really fascinating is on YouTube, you can actually get a copy of just the vocals of that song, and you realize what a collage that song actually is. It doesn't make sense without the music when they just hit, but their vocals are incredible and dynamic.
It's so haunting.
It is. It's very haunting. Very, very haunting.
Part of the story that people interpret, and of course there's a lot of interpretation of Mercury's lyrics in light of that, with things like Bicycle Race, people interpret it as, I want to ride my bisexual, and Fat Bottom Girls as being about a certain type of woman who likes to hang out with men who are gay, and they have a nickname that is not necessarily the best thing to call anyone.
Yeah.
But apparently, the interpretation of this song is that the pressure is the inner turmoil of living a secret life. And being under pressure to hide who you are, and in this case, gay men.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that was, like, Freddie never was openly gay, was he?
No. Even in the last stages of his life, when he said he came out as having AIDS, he didn't come out as being gay.
Yeah. And I find interesting that when Bowie left L.A. to kind of get out of that club, see, that was when the first cases of AIDS were kind of surfacing in the 80s, and he kind of removed himself from that community. What would have happened if he had just stayed in that area? I mean, we might not have had the David Bowie that we know later.
Maybe
on,
so, yeah. It was a little bit before that.
It was
a little bit before that, but it's true. But I don't know, like, I'm not really sure what his sexuality was. Some of it is more myth than reality. Like the whole Bowie and Mick Jagger sleeping together has never been proven by anyone. Even Angela Bowie skirts around it quite a bit in her
just goes up to saying that she found them in bed naked together.
Right.
And that's all.
That's everybody in the 70s.
and then Kurt Cobain and Michael Stipe in the 80s, according to Courtney Love.
It's interesting about Bowie and his sexuality, and Freddie Mercury and his sexuality, and they're really different to me. Although, as a gay person, Queen, I identified with that. That was the very first album I ever bought, was Night at the Opera. I heard it in the record store or the stereo store where they sell stereos. They would play really stereophonic. That's a very stereophonic album. Mm-hmm. It's really incredible. It's like, I've never heard this before. And I remember working on my dad's construction crew, and there was a bunch of college jocks shoveling sand and making driveways, and they're like, what kind of music do you like? And I was like, I like Queen. And I was 12. I was 12 years old. But Queen, they had the commercial success that Bowie really didn't have at that period. I mean, they were selling millions and top 10, top number one songs, and for Freddie Mercury to come out as gay would hurt those sales. It really would.
And yet it's so obvious, because you have also the contrast of Bowie's androgyny and Freddie Mercury's hyper-masculine look, which the rock world is very macho, too. Mm-hmm.
It is. That's why I think we tried to tell the story of glam rock, and it started in the UK. I really believe that's the British were influenced by some stuff here, but glam rock was sort of a response to this long symphonic music, and it's like, let's get back to rock and roll and have fun. But when glam rock came over to the United States, it couldn't be androgynous anymore. It had to be more like Kiss, Violet, and Kung Kung, and Iggy Pop, and this sort of blood and violence.
In the course of that, you also get Mark Bolan of T Rex, who was also
a huge contemporary of Bowie's while he was alive.
And closeted about his sexuality, but it comes out in the whole glitter, glam expression.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really interesting story. Tony Visconti produced a lot of Bowie's records, his last album also, and he and Mark Bolan and Bowie were all really good friends, and they all had sons around the same time. And as a joke, they named their sons Roland Boland, Zoe Bowie, and Monty Visconti, just as like rock and roll guys who are probably doing a little too many drugs or something. I don't know what, but I think some of their kids that changed their name, like Zoe Bowie's name was changed to Duncan, and it ended up being Duncan.
and David Bowie had a big influence on Roland Boland too.
Yes.
Roland Boland.
And the chalice from the palace has the pellet. Yeah. And then at that same time, I mean, you also have the biggest commercial success coming from Elton John. And then lesser commercial success coming from Sylvester in disco and Tom Robinson, who was the first unambiguously out gay recording star of any note.
Mm-hmm.
And
he wrote a song called "Glad to Be Gay,"
and that sort of killed his career in a lot of ways because record companies didn't want to promote him. He also said that "Ricky, Don't Lose That Number" was the best rock gay love song ever written.
That's funny. A lot of music was coded. You didn't know for sure, but if you were gay, you knew. Yeah. You could tell. But there were those artists that were like Bronski Beat. I remember. Do you remember? Did you ever?
Again, I remember them. The
Jimmy Somerville. Jimmy Somerville. I think he was obviously influenced by Bowie, but also Donna Summer and a lot of the R&B, which really disco in many ways is R&B with a more driving beat.
Yeah.
Which Another Brick in the Wall is a disco song. Listen to that beat of it. It's disco.
That's funny. Sorry. When they were Nile Rodgers, who helped produce Let's Dance, he kind of came up with some of the guitar riff for Let's Dance, but he edited it down because he didn't want it to be disco. He didn't want it to sound too disco. But when he and Bowie were planning that album, the real intent of that album was to make a lot of hit songs. Mm-hmm. It was to make a really popular album that lots of people would like. I think he was at that point in his career where he wanted to like pay off some bills, and he, for a long time, his music was owned by a manager of his who was kind of a ruthless, not very nice guy who ran this Main Man Productions. And Bowie waited till the end of that contract was over, and once it was over, he then got all of his publishing under his name, and he had his music bought by record labels like 3, 4, 5 times. He was able to make it pay off for him and own the rights to his own music in ways that so many other artists haven't been able to do.
I as all the news about Bowie was trickling out and different, you know, inventions and that he had, he was involved in so many other ventures. I remember somebody saying that he sold stock in his, like in himself. He promised the rights to his future songs to, I guess, just the public, and they bought stock. And other artists tried that and it utterly failed, but it worked with him for a while.
It did, and his music was remastered and reissued, I think, 4 different times, and is now being remastered and reissued again on the 40th anniversary of each release of his music. So you can get all these different versions of his music, and it's really interesting how it just kind of lives on. Mm-hmm. He also, we didn't talk about the fact that he did a lot of film work.
Yeah.
I mean, he played Pontius Pilate in The Last Temptation of Christ with Scorsese, and he was in a lot of The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Mm-hmm. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which was a beautiful film, amazing film. And that was during the Let's Dance period because he has that hair, that orange, not orange, but it's like blonde, yellow hair.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's,
very much out in the sun, kind of Bowie. And Labyrinth, of course.
Which I think caused a lot of sexual confusion for a lot of children about that age. You're like, why am I feeling so funny watching this?
My tummy feels funny.
But he was perfect for that part.
He
was just magical. And a lot of young girls watched him in that movie with Jennifer Connelly and fell in love with him. And that was their starting point with Bowie, was that movie. And then they went back and found this. That's what's fun about discovering an artist like Bowie is you can go back and there's this treasure trove, and you think you're uncovering it yourself. Like, wow, I can't believe this and this discovery, and you own it. When you discover something like that, you own it in a different way. And I think that's the way it is with Bowie fans. They all feel like he was theirs, that they, you know. There's enough of him to share for all of us, but there was that feeling of he's mine, you know?
Well, if you think that David Bowie is yours, wait till you hear how his influence has extended for a new generation of artists and generations of artists following his big breakthroughs right after we come back.
This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Marriage equality marches into a Chinese court. Guyana's president opens the door to liberation. And we celebrate outlaw Jean Cordova's lesbian feminist legacy. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
This Way Out airs 2 p.m. Saturdays right after the 10th voice.
The human being in celebration of love, activism, and the arts, a gathering of tribes in support of KKFI, Saturday, January 16th, 7 to 9:30 at the Uptown Arts Bar, featuring Zanzibar drums, period music from Victor Doherty and Paul Coleman, poets from The Writer's Place, Jose Faust and Sharon Eicher, and from Poetic Underground, Doug Nightlife Jones and Nick Gavecci. Host and DJ Misconception. Advance tickets and information at UptownArtsBar.com. Sponsored by Cooper's. It's a beautiful day in the Uptown Arts Bar.
Hello, everybody. We are back at the 10th Voice with the wonderful Mark Manning, the precocious Phil Hoosier, and the lovely Maria Vasquez Boyce, who's working the boards for us.
And who are you?
And I'm Miguel Morales.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. And so we're having this really great organic conversation about David Bowie, his influence on the LGBT community and in music, and how he's influenced other artists and how those artists have kind of their tendrils have kind of infused into our community. And so we kind of want to talk a little bit more about his influence on the people who influence us. So we mentioned him briefly, Elton John and Queen. And I remember when I was a kid, my next door neighbors had a son, and I was best friends with him, and he loved Queen, and he had all these Queen posters on his wall, and I just remember looking at Freddie Mercury with his deep V jumpsuit cut down to his navel, and I was like, oh my God, I can't look at that too long. You know, he makes me feel funny in my tummy, and I just would like secretly, you know, catch glimpses of that poster whenever nobody was looking. I didn't know what it was, but I just knew I needed to look at that. And so I think that was probably my first image of as much of a male body as I could, you know, see at, you know, 8 years old. But yeah, so he influenced Queen and Elton John. And I just remember one of my friends had that album cover that looked like The Wizard of Oz. And I'm like, what is this? There's something about this record. I don't know what it is. But yeah, and then, you know, The Bitch Is Back and all his songs that he does and his theatricality, which obviously was influenced by glam rock, which was influenced by David Bowie. And, I mean, who else do you guys kind of see as, you know,
influenced by Bowie? Yeah. Well, I think, like, modern speaking, Lady Gaga owes a whole lot to Bowie. A whole lot.
I mean, she used to go on stage with the Lightning Bolt as her tribute to
that's
say.
That's right. That's right.
We have a hometown gal here from KCK named Janelle Monáe, who also is very influenced by Bowie, and her first three albums have all been about a science fiction storyline that she's created, influenced by Metropolis, the film Metropolis. And you wouldn't know all that background, but that's really what drives kind of her writing for that stuff and her kind of persona.
When Janelle Monáe covered Bowie's 1977 classic Heroes, she said in an interview, "Bowie is a part of my musical DNA in so many ways. He's transcendent. He's a true time traveler, and I think that is a part of who I am and the legacy that I want people to remember. I will never expire, nor will David Bowie."
Whoa.
Jay-Z sampled Bowie on one of his song Takeover off his album The Blueprint, which is one of his popular albums. Also, Lord. The young Lord. She looks like she's 40, but she's really 19. Yeah. And she's very, very influenced by Bowie. You can tell in her kind of demeanor and her music, and her, she's even said so.
Well, and I also think that a lot of the idea of David Bowie being bisexual or gay or however people wanted to perceive him has sort of paved the way for artists to be more out now. Instead of, you know, hiding their sexuality for years, like Rob Halford of Judas Priest, that more artists are able to say, yeah, I'm gay, and I'm making music. You want to hear the music? Because it's I think that he sort of started a cultural conversation for us in a lot of ways that is now, hey, you should pardon the expression, bearing fruit.
Yeah, I think Madonna also, she's reinvented herself over and over again and tried out different sounds, and I think she owes a lot of that to Bowie, and she would probably admit that. Marilyn Manson, Nirvana, Kurt Cobain.
Who are the artists now that kind of adopt different personas like Bowie did? Because I think now most of the artists that we see are kind of trying to sell themselves as a brand, but I don't really see a lot of, maybe I'm not really familiar with music, but people who kind of create a personality, and you know it's a personality, kind of like Bowie did. Do you know anyone who's kind of doing that kind of stuff?
I don't really think as much. Yeah. Even the people that we think of as reinventing themselves, like Madonna, it's still Madonna.
Yeah, she's with the cowboy hat.
She was wearing black, and now she's wearing white.
Yeah.
And it's still the same. And Gaga, it's just a different expression of the same basic persona. It's not going from, you know, Halloween Jack to Aladdin Sane.
Yeah.
Or the Thin White Duke.
Yeah. I think that's what's missing from this kind of generation, maybe strictly produced rock for the mass audience, that no one's been able to emerge with that kind of creative expression that's happened. I remember I used to work in a bookstore that's in the music section, and there was Garth Brooks came out with some other persona, and everybody just was like, "What the heck is going on?" And it bombed really bad. But in my mind, I was like, "Oh, he's testing himself artistically. He's reaching out." It was an utter failure, but I had to applaud the guy for trying. And you know, you can't fault anyone who wants to try and create new
and push their own
push their boundaries.
I think Bowie's influenced not just musicians but filmmakers and writers and all kinds of gay artists. Yeah. Like Todd Haynes' Velvet Goldmine, that film, he originally wrote that film using all Bowie music, and then Bowie wouldn't give him the rights to use the music, so he had to use other glam. He used a lot of Roxy music. John Cameron Mitchell, and Hedwig and the Angry Inch. That's incredibly influenced by Bowie, Ziggy Stardust, and I think those are two filmmakers that reinvent themselves with each film that they do.
And in fact, John Cameron Mitchell said of David Bowie's work, "A mask becomes a safe place behind which you can create amazing art." Tying back to something you said earlier.
And I just have to interrupt because during this program, we've had several calls about how people are really enjoying this discussion about Bowie and sort of the personal connections and kind of missing out on the music, but we do have a song queued up. But, you know, I just wanted to share that with you because people feel really connected to Bowie. So, just everyone's very grateful for this discussion today.
That's really wonderful to hear because, I mean, this is a conversation that's interesting to the four of us, and hopefully other people are finding it interesting as well. And I find it amazing that people who live in the Midwest can connect with someone who is so internationally known and has traveled the world. That's the power of Bowie and the power of music and kind of transcending these boundaries, is that you can reach people in the Midwest and rural areas, and they can feel just as powerful and as touched as somebody who lives in New York or London or
whatever else.
It's true.
That's the power of art.
I just wanted to read just a little quick thing I wrote on Facebook. So much of my journey as a queer kid finding my way in the world was influenced by Bowie. Most of the great music of Bowie, the lyrics, the sounds, but also the way he adapted, the way he was always looking forward, always an artist, always reinventing, always writing songs for those of us who felt left out, estranged, or alien in a world that we needed to escape. Studying his life and music and his influences led me to a goldmine of discoveries that have enriched my life, and I was able to see him live on three occasions. Hmm. And in my own pretend world, I wondered what it would be like to be his child, because I've taken so much of his advice to heart, and I really think the world is just a little bit less magical with his loss. And for me, when I found out he died, I was in shock for about 3 days, because he has meant so much to me as a writer, as a performer, but as a gay person, mm-hmm. as a human being, trying to figure out how to fit into this world that we have. And back in 1990, I worked at a restaurant called Cafe Lulu, and I created a performance art character called Marlo Lo Jones, which in my mind was the illegitimate daughter of Lou Jane, who ran the restaurant, and David Bowie, who I think she met on some rock and roll catering job of hers. But I had the chance to perform his music in drag on stage at Cafe Lulu, and the bartender that worked at the restaurant there, who's now deceased, he got his guitar from Carlos Elomar, who co-wrote Fame with Bowie, and he could take a Bowie song and come out of his guitar. So he would play guitar, and we sang Bowie songs at Cafe Lulu back in 1990, wow. All of us kids dancing. And I think just it was just my connection to his music, but also it connected me to basically you people in this room. I don't know if I'd be connected with you.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking about as we were talking this whole conversation is, you know, I'm a gay Latino, and you're a Native American, and you're a great white guy, and Maria, she's Latina too, but we all
European
have,
immigrants.
European immigrant. But we can all connect with this person who would seem so out of our area, you know. But that's the influence that he has.
Yeah, that's when you.
And that's how we are open to people that as well.
I think that's a really good thing about art too, because some pop songs, okay, you heard it.
Yeah.
You don't want to hear it again. It's bubblegum. But his music, there was more to it. When you get behind the lyrics and you start realizing that he was experimenting with all these lyrics and trying different techniques, and there's these stories behind all of these things, and you can make all these connections in your own queer family tree. Yeah. You know?
Well, and you know, there's so many that I could point to, but like John, I'm Only Dancing, I think, is one where as I first really listened to it, I was like, oh my God, he's actually the singer persona is in love with John, and he's dancing with a girl, and John is jealous. Mm. And it's like, I'm only dancing.
Yeah. Oh, that reminds me of the Smiths and Morrissey.
Oh,
okay.
Yes. Cool, yeah.
I would have to say that they, you know, Bowie came first and allowed them to happen.
And a lot of Morrissey's sound, I think, is tied up with the way that Bowie would make his voice
how you kind of like sneak in the bathroom and you kind of try to practice somebody's voice, and then it becomes you take on those affectations. I can totally hear Bowie and Morris.
And totally makes me want to put on my red shoes and dance the blues.
Well, and he was very influenced by Warhol. It's all kind of connected. If I could really quickly say that Inks, Middle of the Mapfest, and Elemo Drafthouse are teaming up with KU Med Center to do a 35mm screening of the Nick Reg film Man Who Fell to Earth, starring Bowie. All the money will go to cancer research. Ooh. And that's Thursday night at 6:45. And Drew Back and the Dirty Electric and David George and A Crooked Mile and V-Tran Music will be playing Bowie music. And Saturday the 31st at 7 at Knuckleheads is The Band Who Fell to Earth, a tribute to David Bowie at Knuckleheads, featuring like 15 of the best Kansas City musicians in their instrument. So there's going to be two lead singers, and there's drummers, and it's a super band. Betsy Ellis is going to be part of it. Lauren Crum, Steve Tulipana, Michelle Bacon, Kyle Dahlquist. It's just a super band, and the tickets have been flying off the shelf. So, and it's partially through the Deli Magazine KC, and I think some proceeds go to Midwest Music Foundation. So I just want to mention those two events among many others that are happening.
And I just want to say, for me personally, I think my relationship with David Bowie has been that he gave people permission to be weird and to be queer. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of influence that I see in his life, and that you or me or anybody, you don't have to be one persona. You don't have to stay in one box.
Definitely. Well, I this conversation could go on forever, but not on the air. So thanks, everybody, for joining us and listening in. And thank you to Mark Manning, Phil Hoosier, and Maria Vasquez-Boyd. I'm Miguel Morales, and you have saved my life today. Thank you.